Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Okay, so as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about, in the blurb, we're going to talk about this whole Judas problem. And this isn't necessarily Jesus's Judas problem, but it's kind of a long-lasting theological problem about what to do with this figure of Judas, which for me is just like, I think I've even talked about it here before, but I'm always interested in this guy because he's in many ways the most tragic figure in the Bible, maybe even more than Job, because Job kind of has a happy ending, and he's become this sort of scapegoat, all of this kind of stuff about Judas. So I'm basing this whole thing off of, I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago. I was in Regina for a different conference with all these Catholic theologians and educators. And so this is kind of built off of that, but it's also built off of, I teach this book called Silence in my Catholic literature course. And there's a film version of it as well that I teach in my Catholic film course. And what I like to do when I start this course is I kick off with a particular question of the students. And so I'm going to ask this question of all of you, and you can answer as you feel comfortable. But the first thing you need to do is forget everything that Tim talked about a couple weeks ago about hell and all of that kind of stuff. Not forget it like he's wrong, because that's not what I mean. But for the purpose of this thought experiment, let's hold on to the most traditional, harshest view of hell that maybe all of us grew up with. I know I did. Let's imagine that, and then put yourself in God's place of being sort of the person who gets to decide who goes to hell and who doesn't. Okay, again, for the purpose of thought experiment, and let's think about this question: is Judas in hell? This is the question I pose to my students. And so I'm going to pose it to you now. And here you can see there's Lucifer, and maybe that's Judas. We don't know. So what do you think? If somebody said, should he have been punished for his crime, his betrayal, all of that kind of stuff, where would you land on this question?
Well, you don't know.
You don't know. Okay.
Now, I certainly grew up thinking that Judas was most likely in
hell. Yeah.
I mean, that was the obvious.
Right. Reason. It's a tough question, I know, for this community, because we're all, we're sort of like, well, grace and beauty and all of these kinds of things. But you're right. Like, for me, too, I was like, oh, of course, Judas betrayed Jesus. He must be in hell, right? Anyone else come up? Like, I know you grew up in a sort of similar kind of traditional, strict...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I was just trying to think how to answer this, because it's hard to... Because you grow up, and it's like... There's no in-between land, right?
Yeah.
And so then that question and Judas's story, it comes with so many different things about, like, what are your views on suicide?
Mm.
What are your views on... And wasn't... Like...
Yeah.
But if you would ask me, like, in my old days, for sure he was in hell.
Right.
But now I'm like, for sure he's not.
Yeah. Like, even with the traditional notions of hell, you would say, no, I think God would not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, like, even, like, as at the beginning part, I always question that, because mm-hmm. I just thought, if Jesus was this, maybe this was the unraveling of everything. If Jesus and God was this love,
mm-hmm.
why would he send someone he loved to hell?
Right.
and having that choice of it. So.
Yeah. Okay. So you would say.
Yeah.
God's grace is enough for Judas.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Plus, he was part of the 12, right?
Right.
He was part of the 12. And so, I think that it was tragic for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would have been a tragic. So, like, even there was black and white, I always kind of question things, like, in my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I was
going to
say, like, no.
Yeah.
I think because, like, at the end of the day, Jesus, like, still loved Judas.
Yeah.
And Judas had like ton of regret for betraying Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and had a ton of guilt.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't sort of go off happy that he'd done what he did, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could also argue that, I mean, again, according to traditional theology, from which we're discussing hell and so forth, from that same frame. I mean, wasn't it necessary for Jesus to die for salvation, etc.? So maybe Judas is an instrumental part of making that happen, and therefore maybe he gets a medal for it.
Yeah.
I don't know. And if the Romans hadn't found him and he wasn't crucified, well, then what would happen to all of our salvation?
Exactly, yeah. No, that's the question that got me in trouble with my Sunday school teachers when I was a kid, because I was like, but he was, anyway. But we're gonna kind of dig into all that. But that's a perfect argument as well, right? There is no sort of like, it's black and white is tricky. I know Shereen, you didn't really grow up with these stories, right?
I was gonna say I didn't grow up in church, so the only Judas I knew was literally Judas Priest.
And they were definitely going to hell. You kicked off the third act. That's what we needed. Yeah. Sorry I put you through all that, but this is good. Yeah.
But it's going to be good.
That's great. Okay, so that's good. And that's, you know, honestly, when I put this question, it's interesting. You know, this is a different community than, say, like a bunch of 18 to 20-year-old students, right? And so when I put the question to them, we get all sorts of I get all sorts of responses from them, right? And the students that are, even though this is a course that is taught in a secular university and not, you know, by any means about proselytizing, all that, just by the nature of it being a Catholic studies program, you get a lot of students that either kind of grew up in the church, so Catholic or otherwise. This last semester, I had a student who is planning to become an Anglican priest, you know, once he finishes his undergrad degree, and so he had lots of theology in his belt. But so they have this sort of working knowledge of this kind of idea of the traditional parameters around salvation and all of that kind of stuff. So, but what I find interesting in they've taught this now a number of times, and what tends there tends to be this thing that happens quickly. So the students that tend to answer the quickest when I pose that question almost always reply in the affirmative with great confidence. Yes, Judas is in hell. He betrayed Jesus. That's not a crime you can come back from. And so, yes, he must be in hell, right? So others will say that maybe the betrayal wasn't that big of a deal, but like you mentioned, Teresa, right, the fact that he dies by suicide is grounds enough for eternal damnation, right? Which is, again, for those of us who kind of grew up around this, you know, I certainly heard that growing up. I'm not sure why people thought that was helpful, as a, you know, to talk to people who are you know, possibly suicidal, to say, well, don't do it because it'll be worse after, you know, I don't know. Anyway, but that's sort of one of these ideas, right, that if you take your own life, that's, God can't forgive you for that, or you can't ask for forgiveness or whatever.
But also, what betrayal? Would Peter be in hell? He's the first pope.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
But he also betrayed Jesus.
Yeah.
He happened to you know,
he had time to make up for it. Yeah. So, anyway, no, that's a good question too. And some of these things come up, right? I'm gonna just try to summarize a little bit of it. But one student, this was my favorite, this is a very Catholic student, said that Judas is in hell because he died before the establishment of the church, right? So this is a very Catholic idea, right? That the church is the arbiter of salvation, right? That the Pope is sort of the ultimate authority. This is why a Pope can excommunicate somebody, and it doesn't mean they just don't go to the church, they don't go to hell. Which, that I was a little surprised at the sort of the take on that, but I pointed out, you know, gently or not, that would also mean that nobody, because if he couldn't participate in sort of the requisite rites and rituals and all of these sorts of things that, you know, Catholics have to go to acquire salvation, that logic, all of the members of the early church, including the apostles, are now burning in hell. And so I just sort of left them with that idea and let them work it out on their own time. But then I found out there's all sorts of theology about that too. Catholic Church has an answer for everything. Because they get to make the rules. That's what dogma is. But I'm not going to get into that. And I have nothing against Catholicism, all of that. But they're usually, when I do this course, there's usually a few students at least who sort of have some empathy, you know, and they're like, no, I don't know. It seems more complicated than that. How could this guy, you know, a lot of the things you brought up too. So after we have this discussion, as is the duty and maybe even the pleasure of being a professor, once these students are feeling very confident about their assessments of Judas, I like to throw in all sorts of ideas to problematize their confidence, which is what university is for, to problematize your confidence. So I mentioned, of course, that while Judas did betray Jesus, right, this betrayal is preordained according to Acts. I'm not going to go through all the verses, don't worry. But in Acts, it says that this was a preordained thing, right? If for no other reason that somebody had to get the ball rolling on the crucifixion, right, which James was mentioning. And so if it hadn't been Judas, it might have been one of the other disciples. I like to think Peter would have taken that role because, as we know, he liked to betray Jesus. And so there's that part of it. But connected to that, and even more important, Judas's betrayal, of course, brought about the crucifixion and therefore the salvation of the world, which means that ultimately it was kind of a good thing, right? His betrayal is not actually this terrible act, but is the thing that led to salvation in this sort of, again, traditional notions of salvation and that sort of theology. Now, sometimes, depending on the level of philosophy courses my classes have taken, this leads us down this whole wormhole of like Immanuel Kant, who said that lying is always wrong, right? That there is no sort of justifiable doing something bad. But then Thomas Aquinas, you know, has similar, you know, sort of thoughts on that. But then the consequentialists and the deontologists, right? And I'll spare you all of this, but would say if you lie to save somebody, then the lie is not a bad, morally bad act, because, you know, like say somebody comes in here and goes, there's somebody after me, don't tell them I'm here, right? And then the person comes in, you go, nope, nobody's here, you would be lying, right? But you would save their life. Whereas if you go, oh yeah, he's over here, then you've told the truth, but you're, you know, might have somebody dead. I don't know. So anyway, but we'll leave all that to the side for now. So, but I like this question and I like this conversation because it's ultimately not important to me whether students change their minds or make up their minds or anything on this particular problem, but rather that it gets to this conversation about motivation and so why did Judas do what he did, right? This is the question that I'm most interested in. And it's, of course, an important question in a literary studies class, because this is the kind of thing you think about. But it has reverberations in life, right? Especially if we, say, don't consider Judas to be a strictly fictional character, right? Then it has these connotations. It also is particularly interesting to me because I think that Judas is probably the most interesting character in the entire Bible. Maybe Job, but certainly Judas is this complicated little character that is vitally important and yet has been treated awfully, you know, by Christian history throughout all this time. And I think I've probably told this story before, but I remember being in youth group And we were, and this is what kids and youth group do, is they talk about who's your favorite character of the Bible. I remember being like 16, and you know, everyone's like, oh, Jesus, of course, is my favorite character. And I said, Judas. You know? You know, they looked at me like I was a Satanist or something. I'm like, not because I, you know, don't think Jesus is good, but Judas is way more interesting, right? It's like when you go see Batman movie, like the villains are always more interesting than Batman. He's just kind of a stoic figure there, right? And I stand by it. I still think he's super interesting. So I want to think about this idea of motivation, right? And if we stick with the sort of canonical gospels, Judas's motivation is for the most part quite thin, right? There's not a lot. So in Matthew's gospel, chapter 26, and Mark's gospel, chapter 14, this story about him going to the priest to betray Jesus is follows directly behind the story of him getting mad about the expense of perfume. So if you guys know this story, the woman comes to anoint his feet with his perfume, and in one of them, it says that some of the disciples were angry, and other ones, it says Judas was angry, you know, that they're wasting this money, right? And so it implies a sort of causality between that and Judas's betrayal by having these stories follow, but again, not explicitly stated. This gets confirmed a little bit more by John. John, of course, really does not like Judas. If you read the Gospel of John, it's full of Judas bashing all the way through, including this whole thing about him having been embezzling money from the disciples' coffers. Luke and John also have this sort of mystical take on everything. And again, depending on how you translate and then define the word Satan, both of those gospels say that Satan entered Judas before he betrayed Jesus. So if we consider Satan a sort of real, you know, figure with agency that has the ability to take over human beings and make them act according to his will, then Judas, of course, is not in control of his actions and therefore might be eternally punished here for something that was, you know, beyond his control, which, of course, seems really unjust. We can also, though, think of Satan as sort of more metaphorical, so as this embodiment of the evil part of human nature, say, which is another way that Satan sometimes gets translated, meaning that Judas is, of course, giving over to his base instincts, right? So whether it's fear or greed or ambition or self-preservation, there's some drive in Judas that becomes strong enough to make him betray his friend and mentor. And so if we believe, say, that an eternal fate is the result of our earthly actions, then there could be some sense of justice in this reading, although, of course, it erases the notion of grace and all of the things that the crucifixion signifies, which, of course, we know wouldn't have happened without Judas. So it gets complicated and whatever. All that to say, though, the motivation is sort of weak, right? He doesn't have, it's not really fully fleshed out like a good novelist should, because that's not what the gospel writers were doing. But whatever his motivation might have been, he gets a bad rap in pretty much all Christian traditions, right? So directly after the Gospels, you have the Book of Acts, right, which is all about the stories of the early church. And in that, right as it starts off in the first chapter, the disciples are trying to figure out, they've got to replace Judas, right, with another one of the 12. And they say they have to replace Judas because he's left to go where he belongs, which, if you think about this, is a pretty harsh little statement, right? Again, it's not entirely clear. Other translations say he left to go his own way. So there's not even necessarily understanding, you know, again, as Tim talked about last time, these notions of hell come much later than these books were written. So there's some confusion there. Now, at this point in my classes, I also like to point out to the students that feel salvation was negated by suicide, that not only is there no biblical agreement on the idea that suicide equals eternal damnation, but there's actually not even any biblical agreement that Judas committed suicide or died by suicide. Matthew claims that Judas hung himself, chapter 27, if you're keeping track, but Acts, chapter 1, tells us that he took this money, he bought a field, and he tripped, and then he burst open. So he died by accident, according to Acts. But the main point of that is to show, you know, there isn't this agreement, which sometimes people forget, right? That there's lots of stuff in the Bible that contradicts other stuff in the Bible. And so we should always be leery of being too sure about any sort of thing or saying the Bible tells you so. But the main point of all this is really to show the sort of prejudice against Judas within Christianity. And though it certainly has precedent in the biblical text, so it makes sense that much of the animosity over the years is sort of understandable. Now, I'm not going to go through 2,000 years of extra-biblical literature to point out all the places where Judas is treated badly. You'd have to sign up for my course for that, which I'm sure you would want to be so interesting. But I will focus on one in particular, and that is where this comes from as well, and this is Dante's Divine Comedy. So, Canto 34 of the Divine Comedy, and if you know, you're not familiar with this, this is Dante sort of touring hell and heaven and purgatory and all of that kind of stuff. And so in Canto 34, he's sort of being shown around, and he comes across Lucifer, who's here, and he finds Lucifer is currently has three faces, so three mouths, and is eating three people. And so you've got Judas in the middle here, and then on either side is Brutus and Cassius. So if you know your Shakespeare, you know that these are the guys who betrayed Caesar. You know, et tu, Brute, and so these are other classic betrayers. And so according to Dante, they're all in there, and Judas is chewing on them for all eternity. And so in there writes, that soul up there with the greatest pain is Judas Iscariot, with head inside, he plies his legs without. Meaning, you know, so this is what we see here. His face is in there. The other guys get their legs eaten. He gets his head eaten for all eternity. So this is what Dante feels like Judas deserves based on his betrayal. We're not going to dwell on these sort of Middle Ages renderings of heaven and hell and Jesus and all that kind of stuff. We're going to jump forward a little bit and think about the 20th century. Because it's clear when you look at these old stories that from a historical perspective, reading Judas's story and Judas's character with any sort of nuance or humanity is not a popular choice. Even if we think about, you know, the notions of grace and justice, right, those two pillars of the of Christ's message, there's a serious lack of both in the way that the story often gets presented here, right? Not a lot of grace and justice here. For instance, right, you know, if we think about this idea that Judas is possessed by Satan, right? He has no agency over his actions. So what does that really say about God or sort of cosmic justice, right? If this is the case, it kind of makes God and Jesus into jerks, right? That will manipulate innocent people for their ends. It also removes the notion of free will, that kind of thing. John's efforts at character development by, you know, making Judas this bad guy all along raises serious questions about Jesus's judgment, right? Or the extent of his foreknowledge. Did he know about Judas's theft while it was happening, or did he know and keep him around because he needed a patsy later on? It's also, you know, raises this other pretty massive plot hole in the gospel story, specifically why Jesus needed someone to betray him at all, right? It's pretty clear throughout most of the gospel that Jesus is a popular guy. People know who he is, right? And so this sort of Judas's kiss feels sort of superfluous, right? And his betrayal is pointless. And worst of all, his damaged reputation and possible eternal punishment are sort of senselessly cruel if we kind of follow these paths down. So, as I said, historically there hasn't been a lot of grace for Judas, but Let's think about some more recent examples, because I think there is some changes within the 20th century as people try and get into this character. So one of them, I'm just going to quickly go through a few of these, is Nicholas Kazantzakis' novel, The Last Temptation of Christ, which was also made into a film by Martin Scorsese in the 80s. Willem Dafoe is Jesus, and Harvey Keitel is a red-headed Judas, which, if you know your medieval art, will make sense, but doesn't really make sense in any sort of historical way. But Judas was often depicted as having red hair, because people with red hair, like those of us who are left-handed, were, of course, sinister and evil. And so we're treated that way. It's hard to be left-handed or red-headed. Anyway, so... Kazantzakis' novel, Last Temptation of Christ, imagines a deep friendship between Jesus and Judas, right? This, and again, he's sort of taking the story and building off of it. But essentially, they were the closest of the disciples. And so in this telling of the story, he's Jesus is very aware of his divine path, and so he asks Judas to betray him, right? And so that he can get this whole process started. So I'll just read a little bit of it here from the novel. So Jesus nodded to Judas, who came and marched by his side. The two of them must have had secrets to exchange, for they spoke softly. Sometimes Jesus would lower his head, sometimes Judas, and each carefully weighed his words in response to the other, as though each were a gold piece. "I'm sorry, Judas, my brother," Jesus said, "but it is necessary. I asked you before, Rabbi, is there no other way?" "No, Judas, my brother, I too should have liked one. I too hoped that waiting for one, I hoped and waited for one until now, but in vain. No, there is no other way. The end of the world is here. The world, this kingdom of the devil, will be destroyed, and the kingdom of heaven will come. I shall bring it. How? By dying. There is no other way. Do not quiver, Judas, my brother. In 3 days I shall rise again. You tell me this in order to comfort me and make me able to betray you without rending my own heart. You say I have the endurance. You say it in order to give me strength. No, the closer we come to the terrible moment, no, Rabbi, I won't be able to endure. Yes, you will, Judas, my brother. God will give you the strength, as much as you lack, because it is necessary. It is necessary for me to be killed and for you to betray me. We too must save the world. Help me. Judas bowed his head. After a moment, he asked, "If you had to betray your master, would you do it?" Jesus reflected for a long time. Finally, he said, "No, I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to. That is why God pitied me and gave me the easier task, to be crucified." So here you have, you know, this a much more complex and nuanced version of this relationship, right? Where you have this much closer sort of relationship, and Jesus sort of saying to Judas, you know, this is actually the harder job, right? Is to be the betrayer than to be the one who dies, and so it kind of makes Judas into the hero of that story in some ways. What's also interesting about it is that it's very close to something we're going to talk about in a little bit, which is called the Gospel of Judas, which is an apocryphal gospel, but one that wasn't translated until about 50 years after the publication of The Last Temptation of Christ. So I'm not quite sure how Kazantzakis predicted this kind of establishment, but it has the Gospel of Judas has a lot of connections to what are called the Gnostic Gospels. I'm not going to get into all of that, but there was these sort of ideas floating around already that Judas was, you know, sort of a bit more of a hero than what's often sort of portrayed. So that's one idea that's come up. Another one that I find really interesting came from this 1970s TV miniseries by a guy named Franco Zeffirelli, a great Italian filmmaker. But he made this very long miniseries called Jesus of Nazareth that used to play on TV every Easter, all 6 hours of it. But this one presents Judas as, here played by Ian McShane, as this kind of moderate political mediator. Right, that he is sort of, you know, he's with Jesus, but he's got ins with the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and all of that kind of stuff. And so he is hoping to bring the two sides together to have a sort of, you know, political summit here so that they can work out their differences. And so in this reading, which has some resonances with Matthew, there is a little bit of that in Matthew's gospel. It's Judas that is actually the one who is betrayed by the Pharisees, right, and by the Sanhedrin, by this religious establishment, because he sort of inadvertently falls into their trap. He's sort of assuming it's all in goodwill. He's going to point out who Jesus is. They're going to have a conversation. Everything will be fine. He finds out later that no, in fact, this is all about they just wanted to trap him and crucify him, right, and turn him over to the Romans. So an interesting kind of twist on this story. This is one I really love. And we watched this a couple of Easters ago and spent a long time talking about Jesus Christ Superstar. But Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar, of course, like that song I started with, presents the whole story from Judas's perspective, right? And so thereby offers a great deal of nuances around Judas's actions. And so in this iteration, Judas struggles to believe that the idea that Jesus is God, and has always sort of viewed him as this great teacher and political leader, all of that kind of stuff. And so his fear and hatred of the Romans drives him away from Judas, Jesus' message of peace and love and all of that, and because he feels that he's leading the Israelites to ruin by claiming to be God, and so he betrays him as this way of sort of protecting him, right? He views the Romans are gonna make him, you know, sort of tamper down his God talk, right? But of course, as usual, his plan backfires when he realizes that Jesus is going to be executed. But of course, it does lead to that showstopper of a second act closer, right? Which, if you know any song from this play, it's that one, which makes it all worthwhile, I think. Anyway, so that's another sort of take. So all this to say, and this is only a few of many, many sort of iterations that. Many artists have found a way to present Judas as this complex character, right? But the one I really want to think about today is, again, going back to this novel, Silence. So it comes from this, it's not a literal sort of adaptation of the Jesus and Judas story, but rather is this sort of taking those motifs and putting it into this other kind of story. So this novel, Silence, is a 1966 Japanese novel by a guy named Shusaku Endo, who fits into probably the tiniest category of writers because he's identified as a Japanese Catholic author, which, if you know anything about Japanese Catholicism, there's like 300,000 Japanese Catholics, and he is one of them. But he wrote this novel in the 60s. He's long dead now, but is one of the, you know, sort of great works of Japanese literature. And of course, the film has been adapted a couple times into films, once in the 70s in Japan, and then 2016 by Martin Scorsese, which, you saw the blurb, I said, try and watch it if you can. I doubt anybody had time, but it's a good movie to watch. We're going to look at a little bit of it in a minute. So in this addition to the book, Martin Scorsese wrote introduction because he was actively working on the adaptation at the time, and he has some interesting things to say about the characters here, and especially this Judas connection. So I'm just going to read this quickly. So he says, Silence is a story of a man who learns so painfully that God's love is more mysterious than he knows, that he leaves much more to the ways of men than we realize, and that he is always present even in his silence. For me, it is the story of one who begins on the path of Christ and who ends replaying the role of Christianity's greatest villain, Judas. He is almost literally follows in his footsteps. In doing so, he comes to understand the role of Judas. This is one of the most painful dilemmas in all of Christianity. What was Judas's role? What was expected of him by Christ? What is expected of him by us today? Endo looks at the problem of Judas more directly than any other artist I know. He understood that in order for Christianity to live, to adapt itself to other cultures and historical moments, it needs not just the figure of Christ, but the figure of Judas as well. He says a lot of interesting things here, but one of the key phrases that he throws out there that I think is really interesting is this one. He calls Judas Christianity's greatest villain, right? Which is, again, the way a lot of us grew up, the way we learned, this would ring true, right, as a descriptor of him, right? We were taught he betrayed Jesus, he is evil, he is a villain, right? But as, you know, we sort of discussed with, other than John's, you know, real mean take on things, the Bible doesn't really make him seem all that bad. But it has come from all of these layers of culture, right? That we've sort of adapted, we've taken these stories and we've learned. And so what this novel does, and we're going to dig into it a little bit, is upend this question in an interesting way, because it takes a character who is trying to be like Christ, and we watch him as he slowly becomes like Judas. So in the interest of context, I'm going to give you a very quick summary of the story. It's not, you know, super important, but so the novel is set in mid 17th century Japan, so 1600 somewhere in there, and it's about these two Jesuit priests, so Father Rodriguez and Father Garupe, Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver, for those of you keeping track, And they go off to provincial Japan in search of their mentor, Father Ferreira, played by Liam Neeson here, who is a missionary to Japan that has recently apostatized, right? So he's denied his faith, and he's renounced his faith. And the characters are back in Rome, and they find out through a letter that he's apostatized. They can't believe it, and so they go off to Japan to try and find him, to sort of find out what the truth is. So the novel uses this epistolary form as it's written in letters, and Endo follows this sort of spiritual and physical struggles that Rodriguez in particular has to go through as he learns the reality of the world away from his sort of cloistered existence within the safety of the church. He also has a relationship with his Japanese convert, a man named Kikichiru, that evokes this relationship between Jesus and Judas, and like that relationship, the agony of betrayal is what leads to redemption. So he has this character who keeps kind of betraying him over and over again, turning him over to the Japanese authorities. But this relationship is really what propels the novel, both narratively and thematically, right? This dynamic between these two characters remains fluid up to and even after the resolution, wherein, spoiler alert, Rodriguez becomes a Christ figure through an ostensible act of Judas-like betrayal, right? So he's trying to be Jesus. He finally kind of becomes Jesus by betraying Jesus. And we'll look at that in a little bit. So, as I said, throughout the novel, Rodriguez has a real Jesus complex, right? He sees himself as a hero, and again, because it's all being sort of told to us through letters, we get his sort of musings on things. So he basks in his role as his glory of a priestly role. He desires martyrdom, right? He keeps saying he wants to be martyred, right, so he can replicate Jesus' sacrifice. And there are many, many daydreams about his own Christ-likeness. So Rodriguez, of course, then also frames Kikichiru's betrayal in terms of the Garden of Gethsemane. There's a scene where the soldiers come and he points them out in this garden. There's even a scene where Rodriguez enters Nagasaki riding on a donkey, right, which is exactly like a Palm Sunday. So he's very invested in making himself look like Jesus. And these, alongside several allusions that align Kikichiru with Judas, ensure that this central conflict between these two characters is read on this sort of biblical scale. But where the novel really excels is in the ways that it complicates these archetypes, right? So this back and forth between Rodriguez and Kikichiru as Jesus and Judas allows Rodriguez to contemplate the nature of Judas, which ultimately leads him to reconsider ideas of grace and forgiveness and humility and his role in this sort of God-human dynamic. So he has this great passage here where he talks about Jesus and Judas. He says, these were words that from old he had never understood when he read the Bible. And not only these words, but the whole role of Judas in that man's life was something he had never been able to grasp. Why had that man included among his disciples the man who would eventually betray him? Even though he knew the real intention of Judas, why had he made as if he knew nothing for such a long time? Wasn't Judas no more than a puppet made use for that man's crucifixion? So one of the things I like in my class is we spend a lot of time thinking about the fact that he refers to Jesus here as that man. Right, which is a very interesting sort of use of pronoun. Right, rather than saying Jesus, it's a distancing effect of that man. Right, and it speaks to Rodriguez's own disillusionment at this point in the novel, and his sort of feeling of being rejected by God and all of that kind of stuff. But we're not gonna focus on that too much. But this moment in the novel comes just after Rodriguez has offered Kikichiru absolution for his betrayal for about the third or fourth time, right? So Kikichiru, every time he gets caught, he apostatizes. He's like, nope, I give up, whatever. And then he goes back. So he's really got the idea of grace down, because he's like, I could just keep asking for forgiveness and then to tell the soldiers that I'm not a Christian and everything is fine, right? But he's also asking for, you know, he goes to the priest for absolution for betraying the priest himself. Right, so it's this moment of real sort of struggle for Rodriguez, and so there's all these questions, similar ones we've talked about, right? The problem of free will, predestination, Jesus, what Jesus knew about everything that was going on, um, and And so these questions are important for Rodriguez because they push him away from his fundamental religious ideology, right? He is very much a sort of fundamentalist in the way we think about that term. So problems like what to do with Judas are all very simple, right? Until you start considering the ramifications. As we talked about at the beginning, right? We grew up, yep, Judas is in hell, simple, black and white, right? As Teresa pointed out. But there's gray area there, right? What does it actually mean for someone to burn in hell for eternity, especially someone like Judas? So those questions are asked, but they also force Rodriguez to confront the requirements of his vocation, right, as a priest. Because, after all, the issue of forgiveness and absolution for everyone is all works well on paper, right, until you're the priest offering absolution to your own betrayer over and over and over again, right, which is what he's forced to do throughout the story. So ultimately, this relationship, more so than his sort of relationship with God or his relationship with his mentor, or that becomes important as well, leads to this sort of epiphany for Rodriguez about the actual role he's playing in this kind of cosmic struggle between God and humanity. So as the novel reaches its climax, Rodriguez is confronted by the real cost of his refusal to apostatize, right? The Japanese keep saying, you got to apostatize, all this kind of stuff. He says, no, I'd rather die, just martyr me. I don't want to live rather than apostatize. But that's not the price that the Japanese want from him, right? They don't want to just martyr him. What he's found instead is that the officials will continue to torture and kill innocent peasants, right? These peasants who have joined the church, if he continues to do his work. So instead of being sort of tortured himself, he has to watch as others are tortured in his place. And this significantly changes both his perspective on Ferreira's decision to apostatize and the sort of calculation that he's made about what it means to be faithful to God. And so I want to take a look at a moment from the film. And we're going to see Liam Neeson as his mentor, trying to talk to him about the nature of what's going on. We're going to see as well sort of the people who are around, who are being tortured for his sake. So we're going to watch this a couple minutes long. So there's lots of things going on here, right? And I think what's interesting, of course, is what Ferreira says to him, right? Liam Neeson's character says, you know, you're going to perform the most painful act of love that has ever been performed, right? But he says, your brethren in the church will judge you as they have judged me, but there is something more important than the church, more important than missionary work, what you are about to do now, right? Which is ironic because, of course, what he is about to do now is this act of betrayal, right? He is about to step on the image of Christ, and it is a sort of symbolic act of saying, I reject this, right, by stepping on it, right? And, of course, the Japanese guy is saying it's just a formality, all of that kind of stuff, but they sort of need to see that it happens. But it's very hard for Rodriguez, right? But Ferreira's pointing out that although Rodriguez had thought he was saving the Japanese peasants by converting them to Christianity, this act of seeming betrayal was his way of actually saving them, right? These all the people that you saw hanging there, right, are being tortured slowly to death, and he can save them by apostatizing, which he does, and then they're sort of lifted out of there. And then of course this gets confirmed in that moment when Rodriguez does trample on the icon, right, the fume, and so. You know, this moment sort of happens in the novel. When it gets described, it says as soon as it's done, you hear the cock crow, right? Which of course is allusions to Peter and all of that. But Scorsese has chosen to score it with this absolute silence, right? Which is of course thematically important to the film. And I'm going to come back to that notion of silence in a little while. So what also happens in this moment, of course, is that Rodriguez hears the voice of Jesus, right, in this moment of his apostatizing. Now, whether or not that's supposed to be Rodriguez's thoughts or a legitimate mystical experience is not really made clear either in the film or in the novel. But either way, at the moment of apostatizing, right, of betraying Jesus, Rodriguez hears the voice of Jesus telling him that it is okay to betray him, right? And so this scene has connections to both the last temptation of Christ and the Gospel of Judas, in that it is Jesus saying to his betrayer, I want you to betray me, right? In that sort of way. And so, again, in this book, The Gospel of Judas, one of the scholars is working on it, a guy named Bart Ehrman, points out in this essay that he writes about the nature of Judas there. So here he says, here Judas is not, in the Gospel of Judas, is not the evil, corrupt, devil-inspired follower of Jesus who betrayed his master by handing him over to his enemies. He is instead Jesus' closest intimate and friend, the one who understood Jesus better than anyone else, who turned Jesus over to the authorities because Jesus wanted him to do so. And in handing him over, Judas performed the greatest service imaginable. So, returning to the novel, this resolution comes when Rodriguez finally realizes that he is not Jesus, right? That he is, in fact, Judas, which Kazantzakis claims, is, in his version of the story, is the far more challenging role, right, that we looked at before. And the sort of effective power of this moment and the novel as a whole comes from the epiphany that we as readers also have in realizing that despite our efforts to be like Jesus, not in a strictly sort of religious sense, right, but in the sense that we all want to be the good guys in our story, right, and Jesus is the good guy, so we sort of think, well, we need to be like Jesus. The reality is we are more often like Judas, right, in that we don't sort of live up to our aspirations. Right, and so again, to paraphrase Paul's letter to the Romans, right, where he talks about we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and all that kind of stuff, and we could detach that from the sort of maybe religious ideas that has been given to us over the years, but the essential idea is that we are not perfect people, right, and whether we are failing to live up to God or we are failing to live up to our friends or our spouses or whatever it might be, you know, we all have these moments where we need forgiveness, right? We all sin, we all betrayed, we are ashamed, etc. And therefore, we are all in need of redemption, whether that's just, you know, again, your spouse saying, I forgive you, or, you know, God saying, it's okay. So it's okay for Rodriguez to apostatize because, like Ferreira points out, God is bigger than these icons, right? The icon is just an image. And he's bigger than these outward displays. So if saying that you don't believe in God and stepping on some picture of Jesus is going to alleviate the suffering of others, then it is an act of love. Just like, you know, in Kazantzakis' novel or the Gospel of Jesus, his betrayal is an act of love. And so by doing this thing, like Ferreira before him, like his mentor, Rodriguez is carrying out the greatest commandment, right? Which according to Matthew chapter 25, he says, we minister to God when we care for the least of these, right? Which is what Rodriguez does for the peasants by apostatizing. He is caring for the least of these. And so as Ferreira points out, there are important questions about how we treat each other that go beyond icons and practices and theologies and dogmas. And these are the things that, you know, Jesus is sort of concerned with within the Gospels, and that Rodriguez finally comes to understand as the story wraps up. So after this whole novel of Rodriguez considering the image of Jesus as he tries to be Jesus, it doesn't actually happen until he ostensibly betrays Jesus. And so and this is what he's able to sort of move on from this idea by sort of breaking the rules, right? And so for me, this calls to mind an image or a thought from another cultural theorist, a guy named Joseph Campbell, who maybe you might have heard his name, maybe not. I'm too deep into cultural studies to know what people have heard of or not. But this guy, Joseph Campbell, is a major figure of 20th century. He's sort of the one, if you've ever heard of the hero's journey, this sort of notion that guides most stories that we watch, he's the one who kind of identified it through many thousands of years of mythology. But he has this book called The Power of Myth, which he wrote. It's sort of a long-form interview with a guy named Bill Moyers, who just passed away last week, actually. They have these long discussions about the nature of faith and Jesus and all of this kind of stuff. And so Campbell has this really great statement where he says, in thinking about faith, he says you have to go past the imagined image of Jesus. Such an image of one's God becomes a final obstruction, one's ultimate barrier. You hold on to your own ideology, your own little manner of thinking, and when a larger experience of God approaches, an experience greater than you are prepared to receive, you take flight from it by clinging to the image of in your mind. This is known as preserving your faith. And that's a really interesting thought, right? Again, because if you grew up like me, you were taught, you know, you got to defend your faith, right? You got to defend the faith. You can't let anybody, you know, go against it. But the question becomes, what exactly are you defending? Are you defending anything, you know, the actual God, or are you defending this sort of imagined version that you have, which we all have, right, which is created through different means, right? If we went around the room and we said, describe God, we'd have, you know, several different answers of what that means. It doesn't mean that there is no God or God isn't a thing or whatever, but it does mean that we sort of create that thing in our own imaginations. So Rodriguez, of course, has to come to this realization, and he does in the novel, right, that his sort of perceived notion is just one kind of thing, and that you don't have to adhere to these dogmas and theologies in order to be faithful, but that you can break beyond it and even betray and still be sort of faithful in that way. And so by rejecting this instinct to preserve his faith by acting like, as Scorsese calls him, Christianity's greatest villain, Rodriguez becomes the Christ-like figure by finding a different image, one that is greater than the one he was prepared to receive, as Campbell would say. So to kind of wrap up, I'm going to do one more song. And so I've been in this kind of the last couple months. This funny thing happens, you know, I was talking to my neighbor about this who likes to write songs. Sometimes when you get a new instrument, you start writing songs, which I haven't done for probably 15 years. But I got a new guitar in January, and it sort of led me down this road of writing songs again, which is something I used to do a lot. But it also, in the process, so I was, you know, sort of recording them and stuff like that on my computer, and I also went back and found a lot of songs that I'd written sometimes 20 years ago, which is the case of this one, that I never really recorded. I just kind of had live recordings of them, and so I was sort of working on it. And this funny thing happened where I think about myself. So I was like 22, and I wrote this song, and it sort of was born out of me kind of having these questions. And I never read this book, Silence, you know, but I was paying attention to other things, and I was working through my faith, you know, with fear and trembling and all of that. And one of the big influences on me was this Swedish film director, a guy named Ingmar Bergman, who talks about silence all the time and that kind of thing. And so I was sort of working through it in this song, and I kind of rediscovered it. And it's this funny thing where you're like, wow, 22-year-old me actually had some insights I thought were more recent, but were around back then. And so it connects to, you know, as we looked at that clip, right, the sound of silence, again, not pulling on Paul Simon here, but this notion of, you know, the sort of silence of God, which can be sort of terrifying. Right, but in this film, the silence is this moment where Rodriguez expects damnation. Right, he expects fire and brimstone and all of this kind of stuff, but instead he's confronted by silence. Right, and it goes on, you know, without sort of any direct punishment. And for me, you know, for the first like 25 years of my life, I was always worried sick about the rules of Christianity, and that God was usually disappointed and sometimes angry with my behavior because I could never sort of live up to these rules, right? And that God was vengeful and angry. And this is why he sent Judas to hell, even though he set up the whole, plot for that story. But that was the sort of idea I had. But what I found over and over again was this sort of silence, right? But unlike Ingmar Bergman, who I mentioned, who chalks up the silence of God to absence, right? He would sort of say, there is no God, and this is why it's silent. I found for myself this kind of comforting notion in the idea of silence, especially in the way that it was more frequently at that time drowning out the noise of Christianity, right? This sort of noise that I had been brought up with, the sort of religious expectations, all of that kind of stuff. And so this song is kind of born out of that realization and that sort of idea. And you know, and also the understanding that I was coming to that I don't know what God is, right, as a thing. And I definitely don't know what God wants. And coming to the understanding that nobody else really does either, right? That we're all just kind of struggling through to figure things out. But what we do have is this sort of set of ideas in the Gospels that are often that are attributed to Jesus, however the history of that works out. But this idea that if these ideas of love and grace and you know, putting others before you, all these kinds of things, that if human beings could actually put these into practice, would probably make the world a better place, right? if we could ever live up to these things. And so this song, which is called Fearful Symmetry, which is borrowed from Blake's Tiger poem, is about this sort of embracing of silence and finding something maybe on the other side of this silence. And so... You know, I'm doing this sort of Leonard Cohen thing of mixing in romantic love with sort of spiritual love and all of that kind of stuff, in order to sort of think about this movement from fear and fear of judgment and fear of God and all of that kind of stuff to an embracing of the unknown, which is embodied in this. In this kind of silence or this kind of fearful symmetry is the phrase that I use, again, which I borrowed from another poet. So we'll do this and then we'll wrap up here. So those are the words there.
Feel my weary
thought I had you all sussed out. I didn't know the half of it. So let's come, shut up all the noises. Feel my will is open. Fearful. All right, so we'll close it off there. Thanks, everybody. And how does Tim end this piece?